Hello, I'm Kenny Walters, editor of AC Design, and welcome to the Doc Talk podcast. Gastrointestinal disorders like irritable bowel syndrome and GERD. But until very recently, the recommendation for patients was always to eat healthy, without going into specifics on what that exactly entailed. Recently, more and more evidence-based research has pointed to specifics in diet that could help individuals with gastrointestinal tract disorders, particularly the food-based diet. This diet generally involves cutting out more of the processed sugars and sweeteners in favor of more natural food choices like fruits, vegetables, proteins, and grains. One of the doctors that has advocated for gastroenterologists to promote the importance of diet is Dr. William Che. Dr. Che is a professor of gastroenterology and nutrition sciences at Michigan Medicine at the University of Michigan. I was joined by Dr. Che to talk about how diet shapes treatment for IBS and other GI disorders, and how trends in food and the COVID-19 pandemic might impact this patient population. Please enjoy my conversation with Dr. Che. Hey, Dr. Che. Gastro guidelines for diet will probably never stop evolving as food trends emerge and we learn more about the disease and learn more about diet in general. With that said, we just spent now 18 months, 20 months in a pandemic where I think every aspect of medicine has been a little introspective and learned about like what's going on outside of COVID. But how do you think the pandemic may have shaped gastroenterologists' view on diet for patients with IBD and other gastrointestinal disorders?
Well, from a practical standpoint, you know, the question around diet and its impact on patients has really varies a lot. Let me give you an example. Is that some patients have come in and said that their GI symptoms were much worse during the pandemic, in particular associated with eating food. Remember that if you just ask patients, let's use IBS, irritable bowel syndrome, as an example. If you ask IBS patients whether or not their symptoms are related to eating a meal, it turns out that 75-80% of IBS patients say that food is a really important trigger for their GI symptoms of abdominal pain, diarrhea, bloating. And during the pandemic, a lot of patients would come in and say that their symptoms had substantially worsened. And this really shouldn't come as a terrible surprise, just because the other major trigger for patients' symptoms is stress and anxiety. So when you combine changing your eating habits, changing your sleeping habits, the marked increase in stress and anxiety around all things pandemic, surprise, surprise, that a lot of patients' GI symptoms got worse. Now, here's the interesting thing is the flip side is also true, meaning that I've had IBS patients come in and say, I've never felt better. Why? Because they are sleeping better, because they're staying at home and not eating out as often. They're eating healthier foods and they're in control of, you know, what they eat, when they eat, how they eat. So It's gone both ways. Some patients got worse. Some patients actually got better during the pandemic as it pertains to food. Now, your question was around how gastroenterologists view diet. And I don't know how much influence the pandemic had on it, but I do know this, and that's that as time goes on, gastroenterologists are absolutely coming around to the fact that we've been overlooking food as a really important factor in the overall prescription for patients with almost any GI disorder, whether you're talking about gastroesophageal reflux disease, so heartburn, or you're talking about upper GI symptoms like abdominal pain, nausea, vomiting, irritable bowel syndrome, as we already alluded to, abdominal pain and altered bowel habits, constipation or diarrhea or both, bloating. All of these things are highly dependent upon what you eat in addition to other factors.
Interesting. Now, are you worried that, because obviously like food can be a preventative thing, people who are eating healthy tend to lower their risk of intestinal disorders. Do you believe the pandemic might expand the patient pool a little with people who probably, the people who are on the side of their diet got worse during the pandemic may have really gotten worse during the pandemic than they normally would?
Yeah, I don't know. It's an interesting question, and it would be fun to study that with a survey. You know, I think a lot of it depends on your individual circumstances. You know, I think that people with means actually ate a lot healthier during the pandemic, but people that didn't have means probably weren't able to eat healthier. They probably had to just buy foods they could afford. And let's be honest, most inexpensive foods are not necessarily the healthiest choices for people. Very rich in sugars, in chemicals and preservatives, processed foods. So the inexpensive foods tend to be the ones that are least healthy for you. So to some extent, as I mentioned, probably your specific life circumstances had a big influence on, you know, whether your diet got better or got worse during the pandemic.
Okay. Now, for COVID patients who have COVID, like you hear things like a patient may have lost 30 pounds in a month fighting off COVID, hasn't eaten. Well, when a situation like that occurs, and obviously COVID's not the first disorder that makes people lose weight just from not eating and feeling sick all the time. When a patient goes through a situation like that, how does that impact their gastrointestinal health?
Yeah, well, think of it this way. If you are altering your diet and not eating to the point where you've lost a significant amount of weight, in the case that you mentioned 30 pounds, which is really quite extreme, even if you'd lost 10 pounds, not necessarily voluntarily, you know, a lot of us, let's be honest, could afford to lose 10 pounds. But if you're not eating or altering your diet in a way that's caused you to lose 10 plus pounds, that has widespread effects on the function in your body. So not only your GI tract, but actually your whole body. Remember that nutrition is really central to the normal functioning of all of your organ systems and your cognitive emotional function. All of that is intertwined and plays together to cause you to feel well from day to day, to cause you to be able to think clearly and carry out your daily activities. So dramatically altering your diet in a way that causes you to lose significant weight has to have effects on your overall gut health as well as your overall health and how you feel.
And you kind of alluded to this before, but do you think we have a good understanding on how important diet is for gastro health?
I think we're just starting to scratch the surface. And I think that over the last 10 years in particular, diet has really become front and center in regards to gut health. Like, we know that a healthy diet plays a really important role in the normal development, the normal function, the normal sensation within the gastrointestinal tract. Remember that what you eat firm or very strongly influences what's living inside of you. So your microbiome, which everybody's hearing so much about these days, remember that the largest proportion of bacteria in your body reside in your gastrointestinal tract, literally trillions of bacteria. And many people have described the gut microbiome as an extra organ, because not only do those microbes play a role in digesting, helping to digest your food, digest and absorb your food, but they also play a critically important role by releasing various neurotransmitters and chemicals and metabolic byproducts that influence how your GI tract functions, indeed how your whole body functions. And a really interesting discussion that's emerging right now is the interaction between the brain-gut microbiome axis. So how the food we eat influences the microbiome that lives inside of the GI tract, and how that microbiome actually then influences cognitive emotional function, and also all of the different functions within our body, particularly in the GI tract. So diet plays a critically important role in gut health.
Now, food and diet is very trendy. And I was thinking about this before. If you compare today to 20 years ago, the amount of, let's say, avocados that people are eating today is much greater. And I was just at the grocery store, and there was probably 20 to 25 different kombucha options for me to purchase. And obviously, there's things on the other side that probably aren't as good for your gut that we're eating now. How difficult is it to come up with guidelines and recommendations on diet when diet changes so frequently and things like kombucha emerge as very popular, but who knows if they'll be popular 10 years from now and something else?
Yeah, I mean, the question that you raise is such a critically important one, because you're right, diet really has become very trendy and popular. And that's a good thing. I'm glad people are paying attention to diet. We're certainly doing a lot of research on diet, whereas we did almost exclusively research on drugs, 10, 15 years ago. So I'm excited about the fact that diet and behavior have really come front and center in terms of being part of every patient's prescription. But right now, I'd have to say that there are many aspects of diet that in which you could use the phrase buyer beware. In other words, there are many, many diet recommendations right now, which make a lot of sense when people talk very broadly and abstractly about why they might be beneficial. But if you really scratch the surface on most of these recommendations, they're not founded in science or evidence. And I would say that one thing that I've learned over the last 10 years is that it's the responsibility of the scientific and medical community to treat diet as not only an equal partner to medications in terms of the treatment plan, but also in terms of the rigor and the desire to investigate various diet interventions to prove whether they're beneficial or not. The absence of doing that really makes people vulnerable to, the next snake oil. There are a lot of people that, and they may very well firmly believe what they're actually espousing. But again, if you scratch the surface on many of the claims around many of the dietary supplements and diet interventions that are being promoted, and even what many that are popular right now, that what you'll find is that there's very little scientific evidence. Now, that doesn't mean they don't work, but it doesn't mean they do work. And again, this is why I said earlier that it's very much a buyer beware kind of situation. There are definitely interventions as well for which there's no clear evidence that people are making a lot of money on these interventions. So unfortunately, there has to be a degree of bias that's involved in relation to people profiting from other people purchasing or buying into these interventions. We just have to do a better job of studying things so that we can help people to understand what does and what doesn't work.
Interesting. Now, you talked about diet being almost equal to medication in treating something like IBD. When you have a patient and you're first initially diagnosing them with IBD and you tell them, we're going to put you on this biologic or this treatment and we want you to change your diet in this way, which one do they generally push back on? Is it the diet that they're kind of like, they may not be comfortable with?
First of all, it's really important to draw the distinction between IBD and IBS. So IBD is inflammatory bowel disease. Those are conditions like Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis. There is some preliminary data to suggest that diet can be beneficial, usually for mild to moderate disease, not severe disease. And in fact, diet does not replace medications under any circumstances in patients that have, you know, severe disease. On the other hand, IBS is irritable bowel syndrome, and IBS is a symptom-based condition in which patients complain of abdominal pain and altered bowel habits like diarrhea, constipation, or a combination, a mixture of both. And there, mild, moderate, severe symptoms, diet has been found to be a really important part of the prescription. So for IBS, really all gastroenterologists at this point are utilizing diet. In fact, we did a survey of over 1,500 gastroenterologists from all over the United States a couple of years ago, showing that more than three quarters were now routinely recommending diet interventions for their IBS patients. And in addition to that, around 90% actually felt that diet therapies were at least as effective as the medical treatment options they had for IBS. So for IBS, diet has really become an important part of the prescription. For IBD, it's very much in the infancy of that discussion. There is data to suggest that it helps with symptoms. What's not as clear for IBD is whether or not diet by itself can actually heal inflammation and ulceration in the GI tract. So those are two very different discussions, and it's really important for your listeners not to think that they're the same thing, because they're not.
Gotcha. All right. And when, I guess, an IBS patient, when challenging them to change their diet, do you see a lot of patients kind of stick to it for a little while, but maybe revert back or sometimes? Because diet seems like it's something that's very hard to change. It's a full lifestyle change.
Yeah, I think the answer to your question is yes, for sure. And some diets are less restrictive and easier to do than others. Like, for example, the most popular diet intervention for IBS right now is something called the low FODMAP diet. And the low FODMAP diet can be challenging to implement into one's daily life. It's really important, though, to remember that the low FODMAP diet is a three-phase program in which patients eliminate a wide range of foods containing sugars that are difficult for your GI tract to digest and absorb. If you get better with that more restrictive phase of the diet program, which typically lasts 4 to 6 weeks, then you go through a phase where foods containing individual FODMAPs are reintroduced to determine a patient's sensitivities. Because for example, most patients are reacting to fructans, the sugar in wheat, or onions and garlic, which is also fructans. Those are the most common triggers for patients with IBS symptoms. Other FODMAPs like galactooligosaccharides, fructose, more variably cause problems. So some patients can do perfectly fine with even moderate amounts of those types of sugars, while others are very sensitive. So that reintroduction phase helps patients to figure that out. And then the third phase uses the information from the second phase, uses the sensitivities that are identified in the second phase to personalize and liberalize a person's diet. So, you know, 6 months down the road, after a person started the low FODMAP diet, more than 80%, 85% of the patients are able to liberalize their diet through that reintroduction and personalization phase. of the diet plan. Now, so these diet strategies can be very challenging to implement. And by the way, the reason I explained all that is so people know the information, but also just to give people an understanding of what's involved if you really implement the low FODMAP diet properly. And this is why we as gastroenterologists, and me as, you know, as somebody that helped to pioneer this strategy in the United States, we work hand in hand with a trained GI dietitian. In other words, one of the things that really improves adherence to any of the diet strategies is having an expert explain the diet and help people to understand how to implement and operationalize a diet in their day-to-day lives in a way that isn't so intrusive and difficult and confusing. So seeing a trained GI dietitian, not just a general dietitian, but a trained GI dietitian can be extremely helpful in terms of providing resources, helping you, answering your questions, spending sufficient time with a patient so that they have a deep enough understanding to be able to try the diet and stay on the diet, and hopefully find a solution to their problems.
Now, my final question then would be, is this the most challenging time to be a gastroenterologist and promote a good diet when so much of the food is processed, there's sugar in everything, and there's so much misinformation out there? I know it's probably a better conversation with people who are dealing with the virus and the vaccines and stuff like that, but it's true for every field that you could go out and I could find information on that tells me anything with diet, that gives me the worst advice in the world, that acts like it's written in stone, this is true. So does that make it just so much difficult, the access we have today?
Yes and no. Here's the thing is that if you had asked me this question 5 to 7 years ago, I would have said yes. But it's actually getting better now. Why? Because patients already recognize the association between eating and their GI symptoms. Patients for years and years and years have been coming to doctors, primary care doctors, gastroenterologists, others, and saying, look, doc, you know, when I eat a meal, that's when I get my problems. How can I change my diet in a way that helps me to address the problems? And you know what the doctor's response? We really don't have any evidence-based diet treatments for you. I wish I could give you a better recommendation than just to eat smaller, more frequent meals and eat lots of fiber and eat a healthy diet. Those were sort of the recommendations that came through for patients with GI problems for years and years and years. It's only been very recently that we've started to actually have science behind some of these diet interventions like the low FODMAP diet. And so in that way, in many ways, it's getting easier because the patients already recognize the association and the doctors are becoming more familiar with the diet interventions for which there is scientific backing. And groups like our group, there are other groups in the United States now too, are routinely doing diet-based studies. We're looking at a variety of different types of diets for a variety of different types of GI conditions. And so hopefully, as the evidence mounts, diet will become easier and easier to implement, not harder and harder.
Interesting. Well, thank you very much, Dr. Che. Is there anything else you want to say?
No, other than make sure that as you think about specific diet interventions to address your GI issues, that you talk to your gastroenterologist, that you, if you have the opportunity, engage with a GI dietitian, and also to make sure that the press that you read around different diet strategies are backed in scientific evidence, not just hearsay or opinion.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
All right, great. Thanks very much. Oh,
I would like to thank Dr. Che for the illuminating conversation about food and GI disorders. And thank you to the listeners. As always, you can find us on Twitter, LinkedIn, and Facebook. Also, please look out for our other podcasts, Lungcast, Derm Discussions, the Rare Disease Report podcast, and Heartbeat with Dr. Manish Patel. Thanks again. I'm Kenny Wolf.